Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Davis, and stay tuned for Wordplay. It's 4 o'clock on a fine Sunday afternoon, and I'm in the studio today with my co-host, Laura Hope Gill. Laura, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Jeff. Great to see you.
Great to see you. And before we go on, I should say, we're listening to WPVM 103.5 FM.
And so. Today, Glennis Redmond is in Indiana doing poetry, and
that's
Sebastian
right.
Matthews is just down the road finishing up a reading of his...
That's right, his first book.
Called We Generous.
Right.
And we'll be providing a recording of that on an upcoming show.
That's the plan, right. We'll see how the recording turns out. Hopefully well. So, but anyway, I hear you're working on some new stuff today, aren't you?
I am working on some new stuff.
Yeah,
and
why don't you read some of that for us?
It's quite a little stumble that I've had. And I think it would be most clear if I just read from the introduction of the book, and which is not yet published, so I don't get all mumbled and jumbled. Because it's when I get really excited about an idea, I can get mumbled and jumbled. So I'll just read from the introduction of the book, because it's about the alchemical process. And alchemy is... becoming more and more popular. Byron Katie does work with alchemy in her work with Li Po and the Tao Te Ching. We who study Buddhism are familiar with alchemy as a process of improvement and healing and changing the world by changing yourself, which is the fundamental principle of alchemy. It's everywhere, and we see it in everything. We don't have the word. I've not had that word. And it wasn't until I read Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist that I realized that that way of living is how most of the people I'm closest to live and how I have lived. It's just this natural way. So I'll read from the introduction.
Good.
And
yes.
Here it is.
All right. What's alchemy?
Here we go. There is a process going on in everything, a system at work within all systems. It is at work in our love affairs, our psyches, our families, all our world so repletely we can't even see it. It befuddles us, makes us love against the laws of self-preservation, carries us through our darkest hours, and brings us to our knees again and again in both suffering and gratitude, though rarely at the same time. Our lack of its name drives us mad, makes us buy things we don't need, end relationships in fits of disgust, and on a lighter note, fill our homes with stray animals. This lack creates a hole we cannot strive hard enough to fill, with career, with accolades both hollow and holy, with noise, with sex, with possessions, with alcohol and drugs, and with relationships that one after another entropy and vanish, leaving little growth in their place. The lack of its name keeps us in depression longer than is necessary and drives far too many to suicide, leaving mystified loved ones, like myself more than once, behind. Our knowing of this is the root of our unknowing of this is the root of countless sufferings of women, men, and children alike who live in a culture drained of its birthright, the ecstasy of being a part of something larger than ourselves. The immense turning from the Judeo-Christian religion signifies our shared, overwhelming desire for a sense of unity unaligned with concepts of hatred and prejudice and war. We don the mantle and ritual of faraway cliffs and villages. In hotel rooms on business trips, the Holy Bible remains in the bedside drawer with the Akron telephone book, just another means of contacting somebody we don't know. Some hurly-burly god, white-bearded, rendered in Sunday school texts incarnate as a frightening, most likely drunken uncle. Raised in fear of this figure, as adults we strive to own ourselves as actually not that bad. We shy from vitriolic, tired of unproductive self-hatred and the pall it casts upon our hearts. We forgive ourselves. Even if the call from many a pulpit claims that he will not. We turn inward for a light long hidden, and in increasing numbers, we find it. But doing so drives us farther from our original spiritual home that in the end we feel gave us nothing. But there is a part of us, among those raised in a faith now tragically occupied by politics, that still, I think, wonders about it. We observe Christmas and Hanukkah, but we attend yoga on New Year's Day to fill in the blanks. Still, we wonder how an entire institution followed by so many could hold so little meaning. We, as intelligent, spiritual, and kind individuals, can connect to. The words are not enough for us anymore. It is as though somebody drained them of their meaning in the night, only to replace them with something else, something that could be of use to someone other than ourselves. The opiate of the masses has become the opiate of the mass, a high ritual void of our shared participation and undergone as though in a trance. But trances are powerful states of unconsciousness, and something is long at work within us that such ritual still speaks to. But to speak of it like this is called heresy or blasphemy by the church. Millions have been killed for its acknowledgement and practice, including 200,000 in the Holocaust and countless more in the Crusades and Inquisition. Those who can name it today meet in hallowed halls of Masonic lodges or Rosicrucian-tinged secret societies. They are white Christian men, and among their membership and compatriots through the history, we find the names of those who have most shaped our scientific, intellectual, artistic, and political worlds: Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Donatello, Isaac Newton, Martin Luther, Beethoven, Mozart, Brahms, Blake, Keats, Shelley, Ben Jonson, John Donne, Shakespeare, Mendeleev, Einstein, and lists of presidents and highest officials, and hundreds more. Einstein wasn't Christian, but he was fascinated with alchemy. Mm-hmm. These men have known this word and known it stands for all that goes on within and around us. Yet only those of highest degree among their elite are allowed to know its most shocking fact. These societies, long viewed by Catholic faith as occultist and satanic, have long known something we have not, something that only the highest officers of the Vatican must know as well. It is something that could change everything about how we view the world and our place in it. They know that it is the true subject matter of every sacred text and story in the entire history of the world, including our own. They know the very word without which we are lost, and the word is alchemy. And the Holy Bible is, and always has been, only about this omnipresent, eternal process of change. At the time in which the Judeo-Christian sacred texts were written, the ancient art of alchemy was the global religion. The Tanakh and the New Testament are both written using the same system of language employed by the ancient practitioners, but because this system is highly metaphorical and symbolic, our rational minds have missed it. It is a system of metaphors for a single process of improvement, replenishment, and healing. What we have viewed, if at all, as merely the precursor of chemistry, is the practice by which humanity maintains its covenant with the earth and cosmos. Its process is simple. First, a part of the earth is taken from the earth. Then it is worked in some way to make it of good and beautiful service to humans. In so giving beauty and service to us, the earth is healed. This is how the first tools were made, in meditation, of course, and the first cups, bowls, swords, and shields were made in prayer. The ones who could do this, as rudimentary as such items seem to us, were closer to the gods than any other. So it was as well with the ones who could do this with words, the poets, and themselves and others, the healers. They understood how to work with the earth and maintain a balance between her and all who rely upon her generosity for life. They also understood that we, as parts of the earth, can also heal the earth by improving ourselves. But this improvement is no less dramatic than casting metals in a fiery pit and smelting them with mare's milk and human blood. As those shamans and monks and healers who consciously engage this process today still know, it lies at the root of all life and effort. On a very deep level, so do we. This knowledge speaks to us in nightmares we now project outward onto our television screens and stay in to watch on DVD. Forgotten, it still goes on, haunting us, calling us to come back in, and to name it. Our ancestors worked to maintain a balance between what was taken and that which gave it, so every act was undertaken with attention to a living, unseen entity, a creator spirit. Every made thing was sacred because it came from a sacred source. This way of life is detailed beautifully by Mircea Eliad in The Forge and the Crucible. I won't reiterate his studies. It's more of a tale of my, this is more of a tale of my discovery of alchemy through being a poet, its modern day home. This is not about proving anything, for the metaphor is explicit once you know to look for it. My purpose in exploring this is to show that God still speaks to us in ways we're no longer taught to listen, and the universe is always showing itself to us in a way we're no longer taught to see. But this way of hearing and seeing is the exact same application of the senses that Jesus preaches in the New Testament and that the Hebrew patriarchs practiced before him. This way of seeing is the path to the greatest kind of alchemy, that of the soul. Inner alchemy. The subject matter across all faiths is dealt with symbolically, since how else should we speak of something so ineffable as the soul? The symbols allow the process to be spoken of and rendered in art, such as the icons, as a story of fathers and sons, the insufferable tale of the crucible of the family in which we're first formed and from which we spend much of our adulthood getting over. Stories of how grapes must die to become wine. On the surface, they look like narratives. Opening the metaphorical meaning of the narrative requires a Rosetta Stone of the symbols. The Rosetta Stones have long been kept for centuries by the secret societies, lone apprentices, and on shelves of bookstores so overwrought with pentacles it felt just like a sin to look at the window. Christians have been warned not to touch any books regarding this dark art of the occult. But one look at Lindy Abraham's Dictionary of Alchemical Imagery, which I ordered online, revealed to me enough familiar terminology to lead me to examine another book, the New Testament, in which I found the following occurrences of the following alchemical terms. And what follows in the text is a list of about 250 symbols used in alchemy, and then I did a search on the internet. I used the Reims text of the New Testament at the University of Texas website, where you'd key in a word and it tells you how many times it occurs. And the examples were like works appear, which is a symbol that means the equipment and process for the alchemical process. It occurs 117 times. The word take, which is the removal of matter from the earth and the returning of it to a primordial source, 249 times. Truth is a word that has many, many meanings. As a symbolic language, it's a lot like the Navajo and Native American belief systems, in which if it's a noun, it can stand for any noun because all the contents of words are constantly shifting, just as the contents of the body is constantly shifting. It's a very spiritual approach to language. So one word doesn't have just one signified meaning. It can have three or four.
Yeah, a cluster perhaps.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yes. Yeah. And so reading the New Testament this way, every time you see tree, it can either be the result of the process or it can be the beginning of the process. We often see twigs and branches that are broken off from the whole, but they possess all the fractals. They possess the qualities of the whole. Anyway, I found all of these terms, and I have since passed them on to, I worked with members of the clergy as I proceeded in this, as well as historians and classic scholars. And it's changed how I changed everything, basically.
Yeah. So do you think the fact that you were searching on these terms in English makes a difference? I mean, would the, you know, terms be there in the original Hebrew or
yes.
Aramaic and so on? You think so? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Because it's using parts of speech. It's and they're such ancient symbols. Tree is tree.
Yeah. Yeah. Assuming they're translated consistently, as in terms like works or, mm-hmm. yeah, et cetera.
Right.
So, well, this is a rich text, of course, and we could pursue it in any number of directions. Why, obviously this is not, even though you're grounded in Christianity and have sought, you know, evidence of this process, of this, of knowledge of this process within Christian text, mm-hmm. It's not a specifically Christian phenomenon.
Not at all.
Yeah, it's grounded.
Right. And yeah. I have wandered so far from Christianity
yeah.
in my life. And because it was, I think, my grandmother's funeral did it for me. Right, mm-hmm. this amazing woman who mm-hmm. carried a one-year-old baby on a death march in World War II China
yeah.
Was called a sinner. And I just couldn't buy it. And that was it for me.
Yeah.
And I took off and traveled around the world and lived my many lives. But I didn't come to it at all through the lens of Christianity. Mm-hmm. I came to it from poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I was recovering from an incredibly traumatic experience, and I didn't know how to heal.
Mm-hmm.
I was dead. I did not know how to get up off the floor.
Right.
And at the time, I was teaching Chinese literature when I could get off the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing. And I noticed something occurring in the poems where the elements were becoming prevalent in the poems that I was writing. And then I started recognizing that in the Chinese poets. And teaching sophomores, I would learn a lot from them. They would point out things that I would miss.
Yeah. Which elements? Are we talking earth, air, fire, and
yeah,
water, basically?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. The
and
classical elements.
Those ones.
Yeah.
And then I started to look at Li Bo's poetry more closely and started to read about them and learned they were alchemists, that Lao Tzu and Li Bo were both alchemists. And it's like, well, what is this connection between poetry and alchemy?
Mm-hmm.
And then Yeats, of course, was the alchemist. William Blake uses a lot of alchemical imagery. Shakespeare, Ben Jonson. It just took me on this journey, John Donne.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to see the metaphor in so many poems. And I have a stack of poems here. Basically every poem,
mm-hmm.
even the ones by poets. I contacted Galway Kinnell because he mentions, I would alchemize the wood of your crib. You know, just mm-hmm. I asked him about alchemy. And he's familiar with it. And anyway, so I just found that metaphor was replete through poetry. So, well, if it's replete through poetry, let's look at the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the Bhagavad Gita. Let's look at the Rig Veda.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the Upanishads and the Tao Te Ching again. And it's in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's in all of them, using different perspectives. You may be, like in the Quran, I find the person reading it is the item in the trough being pommeled by the sword, which is a symbol of the instruments used to torture the matter. In the Old Testament, we're often it uses the same technique that Plato uses in writing The Republic, using the microcosm, macrocosm of the mind as city.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the New Testament, it's about the story of Christ as the metaphor. And all of his parables
mm-hmm.
are references to different parts of the process. And the Rig Veda are all parts of how to live in the process. How to live a life that will keep the fire from you, and it is to be compassionate and to walk in love.
Mm-hmm.
I found it in everything, and I just was stunned.
Yeah. So why is it everywhere?
Because it's the seed of life, Jeff. It is the seed of life.
You think we just have this built into us?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I think but denied knowledge of it, we don't think about rebirth in our life.
Right.
And so when we get depressed, we think, oh my gosh, I'm dying.
Mm-hmm.
But in alchemy, what we're given is this way of holding on to the divine feminine, like grasping our negative and letting it carry us across some Noah's ocean. Mm-hmm. And letting it, we don't have that because we're not told about this.
Sure. But a shaman's spirit journey.
Exactly. Yeah, we're denied that. And I think that this is why when people go into crisis, they write poetry, because poetry is the Shekinah. It will mm-hmm. carry us across. Mm-hmm. But people who don't write poetry, that's not that poetry necessarily saves you all the time, right, because we have lost poets, of course. Sure. But I think it's greatly because we're not skilled in this. Mm-hmm. And we can be skilled. It can be developed. Mm-hmm. But we don't talk about it.
Right.
And we've been lied to about it.
Sure. Yeah. Especially, well, in Western culture since the Renaissance, it's been pretty much suppressed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
By the church and by, you know.
And there are these people that do know about it, and they use mm-hmm. it to make loads of money, because it is, it, once you're inside this zone, mm-hmm. and when I learned this wonderful thing the other day with it, with I get these, you know, lessons, and I was aware that there was a fountain in a mall, and I was like, why are there all these fountains mm-hmm. in places of commerce? And every time I spent money, I was kind of like, I'm going to think about that fountain. I'm going to think about all that flowing.
The flow, yeah.
And I'm going to picture mm-hmm. my money just flowing back to me as I put it away. And then I went to my bank account the next day, withdrew $100 to buy something for my daughter at the aquarium in South Carolina. And I was like $10,000 more in my bank account than, well, basically, I've never had more than $10,000 in my bank account. And I was like, whoa, how did that happen? And it was because I was thinking about the fountain. I knew that there was some reason, but I wasn't going to analyze it.
Right.
And my mother had received some money from an inheritance and had just dropped a little bit into my bank account.
How nice.
But it was this amazing thing of, okay, well, if there is this left-handed path of left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing, and a group of people know it, such as the Masons, mm-hmm. and they're using it, it's working for them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this is my little discovery, and what I love about it is that poetry and art have been doing this forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're all about transformation.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
And they are our pathways back mm-hmm. into it. So yeah. we're not like on the stranded island. It's just that the ones who were supposed to be teaching it to us stopped teaching it to us, but it never stopped.
Mm-hmm. Just went underground.
It just went underground, and the poets yeah. received it mm-hmm. and have worked with it all along.
Yeah. Even if the poets didn't receive it as a transmission,
right.
they received it by virtue of their craft, or their calling, I guess, exactly. one could say, right? Yeah.
Would you like to hear the Howard
sure.
Nemiroff poem?
Yeah, let's do that.
It's called The Makers. Who can remember back to the first poets, the greatest ones, greater even than Orpheus? No one has remembered that far back, or now considers among the artifacts and bones and cantilevered inference the past is made of, those first and greatest poets. So lofty and disdainful of renown, they left us not a name to know them by. They were the ones that in whatever tongue worded the world, that were the first to say star, water, stone, that said the visible and made it bring invisibles to view in wind and time and change and in the mind itself, that minded the hitherto idiot world and spoke the speechless world and sang the towers of the city into the astonished sky. They were the first great listeners, attuned to interval, relationship, and scale. The first to say above, beneath, beyond, conjurers with love, death, sleep, with bread and wine, who having uttered, vanished from the world, leaving no memory but the marvelous magical elements, the breathing shapes and stops of breath we build our babbles of.
And that's Howard Nemiroff?
Howard Nemiroff, The
yeah.
Makers.
Yeah. I don't know that one of his.
It's a lovely one.
Right.
And it's
interesting.
And then, of course, we have William Blake's Tiger, Tiger Burning Bright, which is the crucible imagery right up front, the furnace and the... It is the crucible. And reading his work in light of alchemy, it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. And, well, Blake has never totally made sense to me.
Well, yeah.
But using the same Rosetta Stone that he had it.
Yeah. He's a mythical writer. I mean,
right. And yeah, very much a symbol.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well, that's
so
interesting. Interesting stuff. Yeah.
Well, it is. Yeah. So I'll be talking about it more at UNCA on March 29th at 2:30 p.m. in the Laurel Forum. It's free.
Free, open to the public?
Absolutely.
People should come over.
Bring your questions and your ideas, because it's a big idea and it's just starting.
Right. And you have some more material up on your website, don't you, I believe?
I've been writing on my blog.
On
I've been
blog.
Writing about
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
I kept it quiet because I was just writing about deafness and on my blog. And I was like, well, how do I write about this? But then I learned this sentence from Joseph Campbell, that what alchemy is about, or not alchemy, what mythology is about, or creativity, about following the echoes of the inner eloquence. And I think that's why I've gone deaf, I think. So I don't really follow the echoes of the inner eloquence. So my blog is laurahopegillblogspot.com. And you are listening to Wordplay on WPVM.
Right.
And
you.
I've talked on long. And I am so grateful for
fascinating stuff,
the space to share it.
Oh, sure. And we look forward to, I'll certainly be there on the 29th and check this out further.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. excellent. Well, you are listening to WPVM 103.5 FM LP, the progressive voice of the mountains. This has been Wordplay. I'm Jeff Davis. Thanks very much to Laura Hope Gill for sharing her investigations with us today.
And enjoy poetry.
Enjoy poetry. By all means. Wordplay is produced in the studios of WPVM on Haywood Street in downtown Asheville. It's rebroadcast on Tuesdays at 6 o'clock p.m. and Wednesdays at 7 a.m. It's also available, of course, streaming or as a podcast from the archive page of the WPVM.org website. So you can always find us there. Our theme, which we'll hear in just a second, is Falling Up by Jeffrey Keyser from one of his great albums by the same name. And you can check our website out. We're also we also have a blog, which all of us contribute to at various times. It's wordplayradio.blogspot.com.